You're listening to All Things Cage at Wave Farm's WGXC 90.7 FM Radio for Open Ears. I'm your host, Laura Kuhn, director of the John Cage Trust, and my guest this week is once again Paul B. Franklin, an independent scholar and a leading expert on Marcel Duchamp, based in Paris and Serret, who graced us with his presence last week on All Things Cage. As we learned, from 2000 to 2016, Paul was the editor-in-chief of the annual bilingual scholarly journal Étantonné Marcel Duchamp, one of the most highly regarded publications devoted to the artist and his work. Volume 6 from the series is devoted to Duchamp and Cage, and an image of it graces our show page this week. Paul also worked with Duchamp's heirs for many years, managing the artist's estate. I brought Paul back simply because there was so much more to talk about relative to our respective lives that might be of interest to others. The career paths we've taken in particular, but really much more, having to do with our respective families and the relationships we've forged out of the colorful lives we've had the good fortune to live. And as luck would have it, Paul felt exactly the same. This week's program is very much about creating a life, and with it, a career. Thus, it may be of particular interest to young artists just starting out, or those with lots of life experience who are contemplating a big change. And as we're reprising Paul's visit, we'll also be reprising Margaret Langtan's beautiful recording of Cage's 1947 music for Marcel Duchamp, heard courtesy of Mode Records, from Mode 106, John Cage Volume 25, The Piano Works 4, dating from 2002. Welcome back to All Things Cage, Paul. It's great to see you again.
Thank you for inviting me back, Laura. It's wonderful to see you again as well.
Thank you. I was left at the end of our last program feeling like I had been remiss in not talking more about you, the man, you, Paul Franklin, and how you ended up where you've ended up. What our listeners don't know about you is that you were born in the Midwest of America. You were born in Ohio or Iowa?
In Detroit.
You were born. Where did you grow up?
In Detroit.
You did?
Yes. And when I was 10 years old, my family moved to a small community outside of Ann Arbor, Michigan.
So
I grew up in the city, and then I had a sort of rural experience as well.
I see. Ann Arbor is lovely. Ann Arbor is a livable place. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I wanted to talk with you more personally about both of our lives because we share a kind of circuitous path, not really of our own design, that we both sort of found ourselves in positions where we grabbed opportunities that were presented to us. And this is a subject that comes up often. You know, I live in an academic community now. And this comes up often with students. They're looking for what to do to get ahead, to get into a position that they might want to have. I find myself telling them, and they're not so happy to hear it, but I simply tell them that they need to pay attention to the opportunities that present themselves and be ready to move, ready to change, ready to accept things that maybe weren't the path that they envisioned for themselves. You think that's fair?
I do. Absolutely do. I come from a place, the Midwest, Michigan, where people don't venture very far away.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I come from a very large family. I'm the 12th of 17 children.
This is unbelievable. Unbelievable. 17?
17 children, all single births, no twins. And my mother had 5 miscarriages, so there would have been 22 of us.
Unbelievable.
A nice Italian, Irish, Catholic household where my parents really loved each other and were fantastic parents.
Wow. My next question was going to be, and you just answered it, that's all from the same parents.
Absolutely. Yes.
That's incredible. Just incredible. And you're the 12th?
I'm number 12. I tell people I display very prominent 12th child characteristics.
Do they know? Is there such a thing?
No, exactly. I'm the only one who displays them. So they're all about me.
Of course. Yes. I like that.
Yeah.
Are all of your siblings still living?
All but my oldest brother. Recently lost my eldest brother.
Recently?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And how much older than you was he?
He was 15 years older than me.
So he was quite a bit. So your mother had a long birthing life.
Yes, she had children over 22 years.
Wow, that's incredible. I am one of my parents divorced and remarried, but across the two families, which remained very close, I'm one of seven.
Oh, not bad.
I'm the second of seven, and have lost one sibling.
Mm.
So I have two natural sisters, four half brothers, and one stepsister. And I've lost one of my half brothers so far.
Mm.
I'll probably be next, but.
Oh, don't say that.
anyway, but so I found myself, I'm going to tell this about myself to see how it equates with you. So yes. I know that you did a doctorate at Harvard.
Correct.
So you did your doctorate at Harvard. I was doing my doctorate at UCLA. And at the end of my doctoral studies, I was given two paths that were presented to me. And one was that I was offered a position at the Getty to join the research people at the Getty, which was economically a very bad idea.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't pay very well. It was extremely prestigious. It was a wonderful place to work, the Getty being the Getty. And I was offered a job kind of sight unseen at Arizona State University, which is a public school, a public university, in a new interdisciplinary arts program with colleagues from around the world, all brought together in this, under this leader. His name was Michael Cerveris. And Michael Cerveris's family was itself a small Black mountain. So they all had, you know, two were actors. His wife was a cellist. His daughter was a member of ABT or New York City Ballet. So everybody in the family had artistic gifts that were really, really full blown. Mm. His son, Miguel Cerveris, to distinguish from Michael Cerveris, is the father. Mm-hmm. The last show I saw him in, which has been a very long time, but he did Cabaret. He did the Cabaret remake at Studio, whatever it's called. I should know this. Studio, famous place in New York City.
Studio 54?
Yes, thank you. I was going to say 63, 61.
No, 54.
75. No. exactly. And he played, you know, the Cabaret leader. He played Joel Gray, if you will.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Anyway, they were all really gifted people. So we all went to Arizona, which was not a sexy thing to do. You know, to go to from, I grew up in California, San Francisco, went to school in LA. My parents, I was second generation Californians.
Mm-hmm.
To go to Arizona and work at a public school was not competitive with going to the Getty.
Right.
Ironically, the pay was very good because they found themselves in a position of having to be competitive with the salaries that the people that they wanted could get if they remained on their respective coasts.
Mm-hmm.
And so the salary was more than adequate to live very nicely in Phoenix. And so there were pros and cons to both situations. And ironically, had I stayed in LA, I probably would never have had the life that I have, you know, that I would never have connected with Cage the way I connected. I also got I had applied for graduate school. This is kind of the story of my life in a way. Mm-hmm. I had applied for graduate school to seven different graduate schools, two on the East Coast. I did not get accepted at one, which was Penn.
Mm-hmm.
No, which was Columbia. I didn't get accepted at Columbia. I did get accepted at NYU, who made an identical offer to me for my graduate school years as UCLA. And I was so torn between these two places because New York is, of course, where one goes in the arts. And UCLA was where I was from, kind of. My parents grew up in Los Angeles. My grandmother still lived there. I had a partner in Los Angeles who wasn't going to move. So I was really torn about it. And I ended up turning it down, the offer from NYU, which pissed everybody off at NYU. They made that known. But what I was going to say about that is that had I moved to New York and accepted the graduate program at NYU, I never would have met John Cage. You know, it would have been highly unlikely because he didn't move in academic circles. You know, he was in New York, but so the only reason I met John Cage is because I went to graduate school at UCLA and I got a grant to go to New York and study interdisciplinary art, which is where I met Cage and subsequently started working with Cage, worked with Cage for years, took the teaching job in Arizona, and then ultimately declined tenure and moved to New York to work full-time with Cage. And when he died, I was the sort of the last work person standing in his life. And so the rest is really history. It, you know, so what happened to you? How did you get to Harvard first off? Where did you go? Where was undergrad?
I went to Columbia as an undergrad. So I was an overachiever in high school. And I was also very aware very early on that I was gay. And my sexuality is so intimately linked to the paths I've taken in my life, because those paths saved me. I came out in the 1980s when it was very frightening for a young gay person to come out of the closet for a number of different reasons. Two of the main ones being HIV and AIDS and homophobia in general, which was still everywhere.
Yeah, it was that was even the case in the coastal living in America, although not as pronounced as the Midwest or the South, the Deep South.
Yeah.
And much more than the East Coast, which was much more, it was much more integrated and common. It was just more common, and especially in our respective fields.
Exactly. Exactly. So, I mean, I was stalked in high school. And it was the only thing that saved me was the fact that I was the smartest in the class. And that all my best friends were cheerleaders. So
they had very muscular legs and arms.
Exactly. And they were also the desired objects of the young men stalking me.
I see. I see.
So these young women were my protectors.
Oh, that's so funny. So funny. Yeah. This reminds me of a very tiny little thing I'll tell you. So when I moved to New York and I was working with Cage, I moved to I was living in the heart of the West Village. Mm-hmm. And in particular, the part of the West Village that I was living in was very gay, very. Mm-hmm. And a cab driver was driving me home one night and he said, he was confused. He was driving me and he said, "You live here?" And I said, "Yeah, yeah." And he said, "Huh." And I realized what he meant, that there was a huge gay population there. And I said, nobody's bothering me. Nobody wants me. And he looked at me, he stopped the car and he leaned back and looked at me and said, "No, they all want to be you."
Ah.
Which is very funny. So it's sort of like your cheerleader story. It's like they're going to tolerate you so they can get to them.
Precisely. So in my final years in high school, I knew I had to get out. Because in my high school, I was in this very small rural community. There were not even 40 people in my class. Uh-huh. And the crowning achievement was to get accepted to the University of Michigan.
Uh-huh.
Very good school.
Right.
Very good school. But just down the road. And I wanted to do much more than that. Because I had an insatiable curiosity as a young gay person. And Michigan seemed too small for me.
Uh-huh.
So I decided I was going to apply to schools outside of Michigan. So I applied to a number of Ivy League schools. The only one that I got accepted to was Columbia.
Uh-huh. That's funny. It was the only one I didn't get accepted.
You know, the alchemy of it all.
Yes,
they took a real risk on me. I think I was a geographic pick for Columbia in 1985. There were only 15 people from the state of Michigan who applied to Columbia that year. It was the outback still.
Interesting. What program did you enter?
Well, I also come from a family of engineers and scientists. So I was extremely good in math and extremely good in science, and I wanted to be a doctor. I applied to Columbia as a pre-med biophysics major. So I get to Columbia. The only reason I applied to Columbia was because I knew I would find other gay people in New York City. So I get to Columbia. Fortunately, Columbia has this very well-known core curriculum, which includes things like music humanities, art humanities, philosophy, and other courses like that. And I had to take art history. And I had never been to a museum before.
Really?
The first museum I ever set foot in my life was the Metropolitan Museum of Art. Not a bad beginning.
Yeah. It's probably, no, it is a bad beginning because you'll think, oh, all museums are like this. This is what a museum is.
I cut my teeth in one of the best art institutions in the world.
That's right. That's right.
So I took this art humanities course in the second semester of my first year at Columbia, and I was blown away. And I actually realized that I was good at it.
Interesting, interesting. So back up a little bit. You had no exposure to art, to modern art?
Absolutely none.
Isn't that
Not even
amazing?
to classic art. Absolutely none. No. I went to the theater once in high school to see a production of Henry Miller's The Crucible, because we had read that in one of my English courses. And that was as far as my exposure to the arts ever got.
Amazing. That's really just amazing. I mean, I, unlike you, when I came from, I jokingly say, I came from kind of white trash. I was California. My family, my parents never finished high school. I was, we were, I would say, kind of lower middle class, loving and smart, but we were not upper crust at all. However, my father was a pianist, my grandmother was a singer. So I had something to take with me into music study, I knew that that's what I wanted to do. Anyway, so
One
it's
of the things
not dissimilar, really.
that I didn't know that about your family background, Laura, but I have felt that in our interactions over the years. I knew you came from that kind of background because I do too.
It allows you, I think, it has held me in very good stead. People have commented, mentor sort of people in my life, that I have a kind of left brain, right brain balance, that I can talk to almost anybody. I'm able to break down very complex philosophical ideas for 20-year-olds. And I think that's really growing up with an intellectual curiosity and parents who welcomed that, but it
Precisely.
wasn't part of their DNA. It wasn't part of who they were,
No. I mean, my background is more, we were middle class, but given the number of people in my family, economically, we were working class, because we had to make our dollars go so far.
Absolutely.
And my mother is first generation American. My maternal grandparents came from Italy, and my grandmother could neither read nor write.
Interesting, interesting. What's also interesting between us, and I never knew this about you, I never knew your ethnic background, that my father was English Irish and my mother was half Italian. Her father came from Southern Italy.
We have the same genes. My
It's
father
very funny.
was Irish and English and Alsatian.
Right. That's so funny. So funny.
And when I got into Columbia, my father, who was this very, very sober person who took up a lot of space when he walked in the room, even though he was only 5 foot 5, but he had this booming voice. He looked at me and said, "Paul, can you afford it?" Because of course there was no money.
Same with my family, same with mine.
And I looked at him and I said, "I think I can." And he said, "Then do it." So I went on work study, scholarships, and loans.
That was me. That was me. My parents had no money to send kids to
None.
college. It just wasn't in the cards, but they were supportive.
And it was very clear for all of us in the household that the only way to get out was through education. So my parents were actually really, really not strict, but focalized on the importance of schooling, as a stepping stone to life.
That's interesting. Because that was not the case with my parents. They had no experience of that. My father was he had a gun supply shop. He was a retailer. He had a store. And my mother worked virtually her entire adult life at United Airlines as a shopkeeper. So she moved parts around the airport.
I see.
Anyway, so my
But
parents.
my father never finished college.
How is it that your father was an engineer?
He lied and said that he had his degree and nobody checked.
Interesting. Interesting.
So he spent all his professional career working in the automotive industry in Detroit, and finished his career working for General Motors as an electrical engineer.
Interesting. That's just amazing, isn't it? I mean, it's just, And my mother
was the most well-educated in her family, in her immigrant family. She was the only girl in a family of five, the second youngest, and her brothers never got past eighth grade. And she went to an all-women's Catholic college in Detroit. She's from Akron, Ohio. So she did a number of things that were radical. First of all, she went to college, which was exceptional for a young woman from an Italian family at that time. Mm-hmm. She went across state lines to go to school, and she went to an all-women's college in Detroit. And my grandfather got razzed by his other friends because he was, quote-unquote, wasting his money on a girl who would eventually only get married.
Of course, of course.
But he stuck up for his daughter, saying, if my daughter wants to go to college, she will go to college.
Yes.
So off my mother went. And she had a double degree in personnel management and sociology.
Really?
Yeah. Hmm. Yeah.
And did she put that to work? I mean, because it sounds like she didn't have her hands full with 17 kids.
She never worked in a sort of long-term manner. Mm-hmm. Although when my father was 40 and my mother was 35, my father lost his job and there were nine children at home. Hmm. So my mother went to work as a waitress in a diner on the night shift, and she hid her pregnancy in order to keep her job.
We have there's so many things in common between us. It's so cute. My mother never did any such thing, but she would have.
Absolutely. Because, you know, these are resourceful people. My parents were incredibly resourceful. My mother never bought herself clothes for 35 years because the money had to go to the children. I mean, she was an incredible example. And my mother was an incredibly gregarious person who had all kinds of friends. She did all kinds of volunteer work. She was a very good Christian woman. In the right sense of that word.
Yeah, no, I get it. I get it totally.
And she was my model. She was totally my model.
It's interesting that so we share that, but we also share something I think even more base in this conversation, and we share it with Cage. And that, you know, Cage grew up, he was, you know, from a good Methodist family. He was an only child. But one of the things that held him in beautiful stead his whole life was something that I had. And that is that I had really, really loving, supportive parents.
Absolutely. You know,
so, and in particular, my mother. So my mother, to her, I could do no wrong. I was her little genius. You know, anything I wanted to do, she made me feel like that was the best idea that any person on the planet had ever had, you know?
Yeah. Part fantastic.
Yes, it was fantastic. And it allowed me to grow up with a certain kind of trust in my own judgment, trust in my own path and what it was that I was doing, which I think is critical. You know, I think in the arts in particular, you know, you need to believe in yourself and believe that what you think is worth thinking, you know?
Absolutely. And I think that your mother's reflections and her positive reinforcement enabled you probably very early to be comfortable in your own skin. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And if you're comfortable in your own skin, you trust yourself, you trust your judgments, and most importantly, you take risks.
Yeah, there's no question. I remember when I had applied to colleges and I was so torn about UCLA, NYU, UCLA, NYU, you know, and it was really, really terrible, this decision-making. And it was my mother who said, where should you go? And I said, I should go to NYU. Mm-hmm. She said, where do you want to go? I said, I think I want to go to UCLA. And she said, either will be fine then. She said, because, you know, they'll both work for you. And I said, I know, that's the drama. You know, that's the drama here. Mm-hmm. But, you know, but Cage was like that. Cage also said that, as I told you this, I think, in our last conversation, that John's father once told him he was his best invention. You know,
and that's such a beautiful thing to tell to your child.
Absolutely.
My parents were more reserved, far less demonstrative, because they had, I think, a very healthy reservation about showing favoritism to any of us.
And there were a lot of you.
There were a lot of us. And it was, I think, a spectacular show of self-restraint on their part. Mm-hmm. And I think a number of my siblings, we achieved so much because we were hoping that they would verbally, directly tell us that we were wonderful and that we we accomplished something that made them proud. We all knew that, but we continued to travel in life and to succeed, not just for ourselves, but because the opinions of our parents meant so much to us. Because they were so formative.
That's the way I felt about my mother. Absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely.
I couldn't bear, you know, disappointing her. I couldn't bear making her angry with me, which I can count on one hand in my entire mm-hmm. life of her right. being upset with me, you yeah. know, and yeah. I would have done anything to not have that be that way, you know.
Right.
Yeah. Right. It's interesting, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Do you still have your parents?
No, I don't.
No, me neither. I
lost my father when he was quite young and my mother a little over 10 years ago.
How old was your father?
My father was 63 when he passed away.
My father was 55.
Oh, jeez. Yeah. So our mothers also were left to raise children by themselves.
We were pretty much all raised. We didn't have the long tail your family has. Paul, this is just a little idle curiosity.
Yes.
How many children were living at home at any one time? What's the maximum number of kids in the house?
We never all lived under the same roof at the same time. There were about 14 or 15 of us living under the same roof around the time that my eldest sister got married in 1973. And my eldest sister got married when my mother was pregnant with my youngest brother.
Uh-huh. Amazing. Amazing. Yeah. So you've got, like, generationally, you've got three generations going on.
Yeah, we have the children born in the 50s, the children born in the 60s, and the children born in the 70s.
Yeah.
I'm considered one of the younger middle children or one of the older younger children.
Yeah. So go back to Columbia now, because I took us off course a little bit. Yeah. So you went to Columbia to go into pre-med, and pretty quickly you went into art history and found yourself really good at it.
Yes, I did. And I was sort of faced with a conundrum. What do I do with this competence in the history of art and this competence in science? Particularly, I found out that I was incredibly talented at organic chemistry, which I took in my second year at Columbia at the same time that I took my first art history seminar. And I thought for about 5 minutes of going into art restoration at interest science and interest in art.
Mm-hmm. So it would have been.
But I quickly put that
aside.
You
could have been a journeyman in the arts. You would have had an occupation.
Absolutely. You know, could have worked in a museum, could have worked, you know, for galleries, could have set up my own business. But in my junior year, I decided that I wanted to study abroad. Back in my time, when you studied abroad, you went away for an entire year. You didn't just go away for a month or two in the summer. So I went to London for a year because I did not speak any foreign languages. And I went to the University of College London and studied only art history for an entire academic year. So I took 9 art history seminars. I dove in and I swam. And I came up for air at the end of that year saying, I'm done with pre-med. I went back to Columbia at the beginning of my senior year, dropped pre-med, declared myself an art history major, applied to graduate school, and the following September went off to Harvard.
That's so amazing. So amazing.
So it was very quick, very, mm-hmm. very quick. There were inklings of regret in my mother's eyes, because she, I think, was somewhere banking on having a doctor for a son.
No.
A son, yeah. And I was particularly interested in gerontology. So she was banking on having somebody take care of her when she was older.
Right, or at least finding her, being curious about her.
Absolutely.
As she aged.
Yeah, yeah. And nobody in my family was in the arts. So I sort of, you know, was a bit of an extraterrestrial character in my family.
Same for me.
As I sort of, you know, jumped off the science engineering track and got onto this other track and entered this sort of parallel universe. So, and my decision to go to Harvard was an economic decision. Because I couldn't pay for it. I meant,
did Harvard offer you a particularly lucrative package for your grad program?
Uh-huh. They offered me the most that any program offered me. And it was the most that you could get at Harvard at that time. I had the privilege and pleasure of getting into everywhere I applied to, you know, so I got into NYU, Yale, Stanford, Harvard, and Johns Hopkins. But Harvard also meant something in my working class, middle class eyes. And I decided that that's where I wanted to go, because I felt that that's where I would be able to fly the highest and go the farthest.
Yeah, so that you, like me, in a different way, but same idea, we paralleled something Cage's father told him, which mm-hmm. was, if you want to get something done, go to the head of the company. So it was the same idea, you know. And I remember when I first started working with John, I had just entered I'd finished my master's and was entering my graduate program. Yes, I had been accepted to the graduate program when I got the grant. And I pretty quickly struggled with the idea that I got in my head that, no, it was, I was had finished all my coursework. Mm-hmm. When I got the grant. And I had to start writing my dissertation. And I pretty quickly developed this idea that I couldn't possibly write a dissertation about Cage, which is what would be natural to do, because I was working with him. And he was so happy about that. He was amenable to my doing mm-hmm. that. But that because I found it an enormous hurdle to take something which was metaphysical and make it physical. So it was
this, I understand
block.
That.
Yeah, I had this total block about taking something which was so mystical and putting it in language, sticking it between covers of an academic language to boot. You know, mm-hmm. I just found it almost impossible. And I took that dilemma to Cage, and he said something to this effect. He said, no, 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 no. You do not drop out of your doctoral program. You're going to do your doctorate. You're going to need it. You mm-hmm. need that degree. And if need be, we'll get you another topic. You don't Perfect. Have to write about me, you know? So he came up with some other ideas, which made me laugh so hard that he was doing this for me, that I said, no, this is stupid. I'm going to write a dissertation about you. So I did. Mm-hmm. Finally. But it was tricky. You know, it was tricky for me because maybe not unlike you. Here's a question for you. How yes. many children in your family went to college?
All but one.
So I'm one of two. Out of seven children, only two of us went to college.
Okay, so that's a different experience.
Yeah, because in my family, I was the kind of different species. I was first, you know, and there I was in school. And not only in school, but I was an overachiever. I was getting grants. I went on yeah. to get a doctorate. It was yes. unfathomable to my parents. You know, it's like, who is this kid? You know,
did we produce that?
Exactly. Exactly.
Oh, it's anyway, true.
So
it's
go
true.
Back. So all of this, we have about 20 minutes left, believe it uh-huh. or not. And I want us to get to how you got to Duchamp. How did you get there?
pretty quickly. When I got to Harvard, I did my coursework and I started thinking about what I wanted to write my dissertation on. And I quickly decided, like I had done in my junior year, that I wanted to go abroad and study. I decided that I wanted to do a dissertation that in some way would allow me to live in France.
Uh-huh.
Because I had this sort of romantic notion of going to France, living in Paris, and what that might mean for me as a young gay person. So at Harvard, no one talked anything about Duchamp because he was far too bizarre and marginal and avant-garde for Harvard.
And what year was this, roughly?
I was at Harvard from 1989 to 1999. So we're talking around 1991, 92.
Okay.
But I could cross-register at MIT. And MIT had and still has a very good art history program. You wouldn't think it because MIT is the school of science, but they had a very good humanities program and particularly art history. And at that time, there was a professor who's extremely well known named Benjamin Buklow, who recently retired from Harvard, but he was at MIT at the time. And he taught a seminar on Duchamp. And I took it and I immediately fell under the spell of Duchamp's personality and his persona. And I said to myself, I have to find out more about who this person was. And Duchamp died in 1968. I was born a year before that. And what I immediately did, Laura, was I started to search for people who knew Duchamp. The first person I found was a woman named Beatrice Wood, who lived in Ojai, California, who was 99 years old and had met Duchamp when he landed in New York in 1915. I struck up an epistolary relationship with Beatrice Wood. I traveled out to Ojai to meet her on several occasions, and we stayed friends until she died at 105.
Right.
and this thirst for learning about Duchamp as a person inspired me to reach out to a number of different people. Monique Fung was one of them. And it eventually led me to Jackie Matisse-Monier, Duchamp's stepdaughter.
Right.
And I met her in 1995, when I first arrived in Paris to start work on my dissertation.
Uh-huh.
And I needed her permission to read some of Duchamp's letters in a French library. And I wrote to her requesting permission. She called me up on the telephone, invited me to her house in the country, and we had lunch.
Lovely.
And that's how it began, Laura.
That's so perfect. That's exactly how my life with Cage sort of happened.
Absolutely.
It was an accident almost, but it was so right. The whole thing was so right that I found myself having lunch.
And I think and I think they probably had similar relationships to other people, including ourselves, where there was this sort of intuitive trust that they would instill in certain individuals and not in others. Wasn't something that they could necessarily explain. It was something they felt, and it was something they trusted. Jackie and I, we just hit it off. And she very, very calmly, very discreetly, and very generously encouraged me along the way. And I wrote my dissertation on Duchamp, and fell in love with a Frenchman in Paris while I was writing it and researching it. And my personal life led me to move to Paris in 2000. And Jackie quickly invited me to start working regularly with her. And that eventually grew into me both editing this Duchamp journal and advising Jackie with certain questions about the Duchamp estate.
Right. In what year was the Fondation Duchamp established?
I think it was established before I started working with Jackie. I think in the late 90s, uh-huh. maybe around 1997, 98, something mm-hmm. like that.
Tell me the family a little bit. I know that you assisted the heirs, quote unquote. Who were the heirs? Who was in your life?
It was Jackie. When Jackie's mother passed away, when Tini Duchamp died, who was Duchamp's widow, Jackie inherited what we call the moral rights to Duchamp's estate.
Uh-huh.
She had two brothers, But her mother invested her with the responsibility of managing that part of the family's estate. And she took that on very seriously and did it until her health didn't allow her to do it anymore. And her son, Antoine, has subsequently taken over that mantle and continues to do it to this day.
And Jackie died not so long ago. What year was that?
She died last year.
It was just last year. Gosh, time no. moves.
We got 2020. 2020.
Okay, so 2 years ago. 2 years. John loved Jackie, as you know.
There was a lot. There was a lot to love about Jackie.
Yeah.
I describe Jackie as the ideal heir. She was cautious. She was, as I said, generous. She was far from a fool. And she trusted her instincts.
Beautiful.
Yeah.
So you've been in France now for 22 years. You've been
22
living
years.
In France.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
You're going to stay there?
Yes.
Yeah. So it's home now. France has become home.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And I'm a French citizen, and I, you know, I have the privilege of traveling with two passports. So what's not to like?
So you maintained your American pass, your American citizenship as well.
Absolutely. Yes.
You're so smart.
Yeah. Yeah. It does mean that I have to every year file two different tax returns, but price you pay.
You know, try not to earn too much money. That's all.
Right. Well, you know. There's no worry about that.
I know that, you know, Ray Cass, of course.
Yes.
Yeah. Ray was deeply, deeply bothered when Jackie died. It was so hard on him. And I think in part, it was because he loved her. That was the biggest thing. But it was also because he lived so far away. You know, he didn't have easy access to Jackie as she became more and more ill. I think that was part of it.
Yeah.
I speak to him. We're phone pals now. We talk.
Good.
Fairly with some frequency. He's as we get older, we have different things to talk about.
Of course. Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Come back to our sort of original question. How do you explain these odd trajectories, which are our lives? I think that remaining open to opportunities is what has enabled us to trace the paths that we have traced. Because we are our own examples. We didn't learn it from anyone.
That's correct. Nobody. Yeah. And the other part of this goes to something we've been talking about, you in particular, is that it never, ever crossed my mind back then or now, ever, the sentence, oh, I couldn't do that. You know, never. It doesn't exist. So it's sort of like, you know, where do I want to take this now? You know, I've been invited to do this. It never was a question of, am I going to do this? But how do I do this? You know, what's the best way to do this? And that goes back to that speaking to self-assurance and confidence and trust in oneself, you know?
And I think there's also, I think you'll agree with me that we have a sort of fundamental need to interact with other individuals. That's a really elemental and elementary part of my work, who I am as a person, and how I want to exist in this universe.
And it's good to know that about yourself. To invite Cage into your life is to invite a lot of strange people into your life.
Absolutely. Duchamp is similar. Duchamp is similar. Yes. Yes.
So you have to, you know, you have to be tough. You have to be strong about that. You need to be able to separate the wheat from the chaff, you know, and try to figure out what will go forward. Who is it useful to help? Who is it most useful to help? And how are you helping them? You know, I find those questions the same. It's the same impulse that I have when I teach, you know, when I have a classroom of students. It's like, how do I hear these people and how do I help them once I hear them? You know, and that's a teacher. That's a natural teacher. You know, it's not a learned thing. It's so I think you as the seventh in a family of 17. No, you're
12. 12.
Oh, thank you. You're 12th in a family of 17. And I was two in a family of seven, not counting the parents, I feel like I grew up learning to be almost trilingual. Mm-hmm. You know, that I had to learn to talk to parents that didn't have a lot of education, or siblings who were all different. All of my family members, as I said, two of us went to college, and the other one who went to college never worked in her field ever.
Ah,
she got married and had babies.
Okay.
So I'm the only person who actually, I have a sister who's a minister. So late in life, she became a minister. She went to college to do that. She trained, and now she is this person. Anyway, I forget where I was going with all of that.
Well, getting back to our original question of how to explain to young people, you know, how to arrive at this point that we have arrived.
Right. It feels glamorous to them. You know, it feels like, wow, how did you ever get to be the director of the Cage Trust, you know? And to which my answer is, I made the Cage Trust, you know,
right.
Cunningham, we made it together. So I created that job for myself in a way, you know. Mm-hmm. I went to the head of the company and I said, I want to do this. And that head of the company at the time, Ann Darnicourt, was on my initial board. Mm-hmm. Bruce Cunningham and David Vaughn, our beloved David Vaughn. You know, I said, we pulled people together and I determined what that job was going to be. But it was paying attention to opportunities as they present themselves, you know.
Absolutely.
And being accountable to the people around you.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And in being available and open to opportunities, it means that you're willing to seize them and also willing to take the kinds of risks necessary to achieve something that you've never achieved before.
Right. And that you don't even know what that is exactly.
Exactly.
There's nobody in your family.
There's a way in which I think that young people today need to be less fearful. And need to sort of jump into the void a little bit. And they don't need to have all the answers beforehand, because none of us have ever had all the answers beforehand. And if they fail, failing is a really great learning experience.
Right. Are you aware of the Buckminster Fuller piece? It's called The Mistake Mystique.
Of course.
Yeah. It's a fantastic piece.
A model.
Yes. Mistake Mystique. People said it was all backwards, that they should fail you when you achieve, that they should move you forward when you risk something and make a terrible mistake. That's when you should be congratulated.
That's advancement. So, you know, it's a weird sort of alchemical, you know, environment where you're a sort of a touchstone and a flashpoint. Mm. But it's because you want to be.
Right. Of course.
You know, it's because you're available, but it's not just being available, because there's a way in which that sort of implies a certain kind of passivity.
I know exactly what you mean. Because a lot of people do make themselves available and nothing ever happens.
Nothing ever happens.
Because it's too docile. It's too, I don't even know what the word is, but I know exactly what you mean. So it's not about being available or being around. It is about being in the right place at the right time.
Absolutely. There's luck involved. There really is. There's a lot of chance that's involved in these meetings and these relationships, but that's what life is, really.
Yeah.
Series of chance encounters.
Yeah. But my encountering Cage was very much the way you encountered Duchamp, in that, uh-huh. You know, when I went to college, you know, I came from just this kind of odd lot family. But it wasn't until I encountered Cage's work that I just got incredibly excited. It's like, I have to meet this person. Who is this person?
Who is this person
that was doing this kind of work? And then I delved into it. It wasn't, you know, it wasn't like I knew what I was doing. I never knew what I was doing ever.
Right. Know? But you were willing to take the plunge.
It was so worth it. It, you know, that I could spend my life in that world, whatever that world was, and I didn't even know what that was exactly, was worth any risk. It was worth, you know, taking a big risk.
Right. Yeah. And it's a risk that involved sort of accepting to make less money than you would in other professional domains. Uh-huh. That's a reality in my life.
Yes.
But I have a kind of intellectual life that I'm never bored.
Mm-hmm. Right. I don't even know what boredom is.
I don't know what boredom is.
I feel exactly the same way. And I've never been bored in my work ever. There's always something to make, you know?
Yes.
If I think,
and always something to learn.
Yeah. Yeah. As Cage would say, if you find it boring, do it longer. If you still find it boring, do it longer.
Yes. Yes. It's a wonderful advice. Wonderful advice.
We have to stop. We could talk for a really long time because
we could.
There are confluences not only between Cage and Duchamp or convergences, mm-hmm. but there are convergences between you and me and convergences in the paths that our lives have taken.
Absolutely.
And I think it's partly because of the family circumstances, the parallels that we have, and there are some, and the parallels between Cage and Duchamp's, not only their work ideas that express in their work the ideas, but their life outlooks.
Yes, you know? Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah. They fell in love right away.
They did.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. Anyway, okay, we have to go. I could get teary now thinking about all this.
Thank you, Laura. Thank you very much. It was a real pleasure.
Thank you, Paul. We'll be in touch. Love to Monique when you talk to her, please.
Absolutely. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And now on to a reprise of Margaret Langtan's beautiful recording of Cage's 1947 music, Marcel Duchamp, heard courtesy of Mode Records, from Mode 106, John Cage, Volume 25, The Piano Works 4, dating from 2002. Enjoy. Thank you.